Well, thank you so much, April, and the committee for inviting me to present this paper. And thanks to you all for coming. So it's actually, I knew that I was following Andy Cole, and Andy spoke about factors that impact greenhouse gas emissions from the beef sector, and ditto on so many respects, but dairy cows are like beef, but they happen to produce milk. So a lot of the things that Andy covered in terms of nutrition really apply to dairy cattle. So I'm going to buzz through those things quite a bit. So perhaps many of you have seen this figure on the amount of greenhouse gases and carbon equivalents, or carbon dioxide equivalents, that come from the supply chain that is producing milk. That's in this realm here, all the way through to transport, processing, and consumption. So this is the total carbon footprint from a life cycle assessment. I'm going to be concentrating mostly on the growing of feed, feeding animals, the enteric fermentation that comes from that, and then managing the manure that comes out of the animals. So my focus will be on that. And so the production of, you know, at the farm level, where about two-thirds of the greenhouse gases occur. So just focusing on these farm-level methane and nitrous oxide emissions, they account for 55% of the supply chain carbon footprint. That is methane and nitrous oxide. So I'm going to focus on those two gases as we move forward. So there are a lot of recent resources. When I started to look at how best to put this paper together, there's four resources that came out in the last 2 years that are just excellent and just have a lot of information about mitigation strategies and practices. One is this manual that came out from USDA, the Office of the Chief Economist. Perhaps many of you have seen this. This is Quantifying Greenhouse Gas Fluxes in Agriculture and Forestry. Chapter 5 is related to animal production. And a couple of us here in this room were part of this effort. And there is great information on greenhouse gas mitigation practices for all of animal agriculture, and a very good section on dairy production. There's also three reviews that have come out over the last 2 years, and I'd be happy to send me an email. I'll give you the links to these. But there is an invited review that was done in Journal of Dairy Science by Knapp et al. And Alex Ristoff published a review in Journal of Animal Science. And FAO came out with a very nice manual that has so much information related to dairy. So rather than trying to summarize all of those things, what I thought I'd do is concentrate on just a few. So this is the table of contents from the FAO publication, and this is available online for free. And so they have a whole list of things listed under enteric fermentation, feeds, and feeding management. So we have all of the factors that impact these, and I'm going to talk a little bit about feed intake and a little bit about concentration inclusion on that. And then they have really nice section on manure and manure management, and I'll be covering a little bit about dietary management for nitrous oxide emissions, dietary protein content, and dietary tannins. And I'll also talk a little bit about the manure storage and anaerobic digestion and manure application. And they also have quite a bit of information on animal husbandry, how different animal husbandries impact greenhouse gas emissions from animal agriculture, but some very good sections on dairy. And I'll talk a little bit about genetics, animal genetics, and just a little bit about the interaction among feed practices, manure storage, and land application. And I put this trade-off signs in here is is when we look at carbon and nitrogen, we seem to get fixated on one form of carbon or methane or one form of nitrogen. But as soon as we try to do something with one form, we can wreak havoc with the other forms and end up worse off than we were in the beginning. So I'm going to spend some time on some of these trade-offs when I end the presentation. So let's talk about methane for a little while, and then I'll shift to nitrous oxide. And I have just a few things to say about enteric methane. Andy already covered them quite nicely in his talk, and the methane associated with manure management, and we've also heard a little bit about that. So NAP, the really great review by NAP et al., they ended up the paper with this figure. And so they looked at pretty extensively and came up, well, what can we expect? What's the estimated maximum impact of the various approaches to mitigating enteric methane? And so if we look at genetic selection, genetic selection can probably reduce enteric methane by about 20%. Feed and nutrition, if we really get that right, we can reduce enteric methane by 15%. And everything combined, the best that we're going to do is reduce enteric methane by 30%, which is quite sizable. But so what I'm going to do is focus a little bit on the genetic selection and the feed nutrition aspects of this. So if we look at genetic selection for feed efficiency in dairy production, if we look at high-efficient cows or low-efficient cows, the high-efficient cows have greater intake of energy, metabolizable energy, than the low-efficient cows. They put more of that metabolizable energy into milk, so they're getting 1.8 kilograms of milk per kilogram of dry matter intake versus lower for the low-efficient cows. And of the total metabolizable energy consumed, the high-efficient cow is only putting about 5% of that into methane, and the low-efficient cow, lower milk production, is putting 7% of that energy intake into methane production. So there seems to be a good opportunity to select cows that consume a lot of feed and also use that feed more efficiently to produce milk than to lose it as enteric methane. So Alex Ristoff in his review came up with this figure, 377 observations, and says, well, if you just look at dry matter intake, there's a really nice relationship between how much a cow consumes and how much enteric methane comes out of a cow. But then he goes into a highlight right away that, well, you know, this is not this is only part of the story, because it says nothing about the quality of that dry matter intake. So the chemical composition, the digestibility, that one has to look more at the quality of that dry matter intake. And then also it says nothing about milk production, the efficiency of using that dry matter intake for milk production. But there is, you know, as cows consume more dry matter, more methane, comes out, and then, but yet again, you have to look in terms of productivity and the digestibility of that. So, Alex also had this in his paper too, but Andy talked about this quite a bit. So, if you have dry matter intake as it increases from the previous slide, we expect to get more methane. So this is the percent of the metabolizable energy that actually goes into, that is eructated as methane. And as we increase the concentrate in the diet, we expect to get greater decreases in methane, but we really don't, that we still are at 8% loss or 7% or 6% loss. So the impact of the concentrate so much isn't on reducing methane, but the impact of the concentrate more is on increasing the productivity of the animal, so that the methane per unit milk is actually reduced. So the animals are actually using the concentrate not to reduce methane, but to increase its productivity. So small quantities of the take home from this is that small quantities, relatively small quantities of concentrate do not impact methane production, but what they do is increase the production so that their animals are using it more efficiently. So if we look at some of the methane studies that we've conducted in our chambers in Wisconsin, so we look at so how much forage to concentrate ratio. We have so much milk produced and 16 grams of methane per unit milk without much variation given with all the treatments. So we have relatively low compared to these feed efficiency, looking at low efficient and high efficient cows. We're getting much more methane coming out, but we have a great variability. So again, there's a great variability in the genetics of the animal. And then we have various other experiments where we looked at tannin extracts. Basically, tannin extracts, they have an impact, but the impact is not that great. Again, coming back to this genetic selection, is probably going to have the largest impact. So we have the manure coming out of the animal, and we put the manure in storage systems. And this is what happens in our storage systems is in terms of methane and nitrous oxide. So during the initial month of storage is when we get most of our methane coming out. So the carbon, basically the microbes are getting through the carbon, and so they're depleting the carbon source. And when they deplete the carbon source and things become anaerobic is when we get our nitrous oxide coming out from our storage systems. And crust formation has a large impact. So when we start to get crust forming on our manure storage systems, that is when we start getting reductions in carbon dioxide. We get a reduction in methane. And ammonia decreases basically because we've depleted any ammonium in the system, and there isn't a source for continued ammonia. But the crust has a big impact, so keeping that crust on there impedes release of gases from our storage systems. So I'm going to shift to nitrous oxide now, and I'll talk about the nitrous oxide in feed production. It's basically coming from the nitrogen that we put in to grow feeds, and then we also have nitrous oxide emitted from our manure storage systems and after land application. So I'll talk a little bit about that. So there's two things that we discovered in a recent review where we looked at corn response in the Corn Belt over the last 35 years and made a conclusion that we could reduce nitrogen applications to corn by 20 kilograms. It would reduce nitrate and nitrous oxide in our soils by 13 to 38%. With the highest percent of nitrous oxide reductions coming from our heavy textured soils, and this would have no impact on long-term corn yields. Basically, the ability to predict corn response to that additional 20 kilograms is so variable, it's not predictable, mostly because of weather patterns. What becomes very predictable is that extra 20 kilograms is going to be lost as nitrate or as nitrous oxide. So fertilizer reductions would go a long way. And with feed nitrogen reductions, I'll spend most of the rest of the talk on this, but we could reduce ammonia and nitrous oxide by 15 to 43% without impacting milk production. So we could do quite a bit better with our feed nitrogen management. So if we look at nitrogen intake by a typical dairy cow, about 24% goes into milk, 38% goes into urine, and 38% goes into feces, so equal distribution. This is when the crude protein content is about 16.5% and diets are balanced in energy. But it's this urea in the urine that is the greatest source of reactive nitrogen on dairy farms. And I'll just look at two typical dairy farms here. So here's a dairy farm that grows all of the forage and all of its grain, and it's only importing protein supplements, versus a farm that feeds, that grows only forage and imports all of its grain and all of its protein supplements. So it's kind of two ends of the extreme, but these are very prominent in the landscape. So the one that grows grain and forage has this much nitrogen that it manages, which is much less than the one that is bringing both grain and proteins onto the farm. But here's the yellow part. This is urea. This is urea in the urine. And this is non-urea, non-urea nitrogen in the feces and also the urine. So there's quite a bit of nitrogen in the urine here, and much more in the farm that's importing grain and feed. And if we look at all of the nitrogen losses from our production systems, we have 81% is lost as ammonia or nitrous oxide from our dairy production systems, and a lot of that can be associated directly with the urea excreted by the dairy cow. So what happens when dietary crude protein exceeds the requirement? What happens is that it has no effect on milk production. This is the dietary crude protein levels that are commonly fed in Wisconsin. What happens is the animals excrete it as urinary urea, or they secrete it in milk as milk urea nitrogen. So if we want to know how much of the feed nitrogen actually is excreted as urea, we can analyze for urea in the milk. And so we have diets that are protein supplements, grain and forage that go into the animal. This is kind of a black box to me, but there's a lot of nitrogen dynamics in terms of ammonia and urea dynamics. But in the end, urea is in balance in the blood and the milk and the urine, so analyzing the urea in the milk is a very good proxy for the urea in the urine. And that urea in the urine, as we know, combines with urease enzymes, goes into our soil system, and this is where we have ammonium, which is hydrolyzed into ammonia, and then some of that goes to nitrate and is given off as nitrous oxide. So, control of urea in the dairy cow is of utmost importance. And if we look at the distribution of milk urea nitrogen on our dairy farms, this is a common assay that farmers get. Half of the dairy cows in Wisconsin are being fed dietary crude protein in excess of requirements. And if we get them to feed to requirements, down to levels of 12 to 10, which is a very high level of nutrition for the animals, we can reduce ammonia emissions by 35 to 42% and nitrous oxide by 18 to 20%. So the last couple slides I have is one is looking at these trade-offs. So this is a nice little diagram of the carbon cycle. This photosynthesis controls carbon inputs into our terrestrial systems, and we know how this cycles. But if we put the dairy cow in the middle of that, we're trying to feed dairy cows in such a way that we reduce methane. We want to keep our milk production high. We want to recycle those manure nutrients, and we want to sequester carbon in our soils. Well, we could enhance the digestibility of the feed to reduce methane production, but then there's questions about how that impacts carbon sequestration in soils. If we're making carbon more soluble so the animal microbes can make better use of it, are we setting ourselves up for reduced carbon sequestration in the soil? So we really need to look at it this way. The same with nitrogen pathways. We have nitrogen that goes into our crop production in our various forms, and we try to control the losses. The feed goes into the animal production, and then the manure comes back. If we try to stop up one hole, say ammonia, well, we could be losing nitrate out the other end. So it's really a question of synergies and trade-offs. And this is a good, if we manage dairy manure to reduce ammonia losses from our systems, as many of us try to do through incorporation, well, we do a good job of reducing our ammonia losses by incorporating, What we do is increase nitrous oxide and nitrate losses. So it's really a question of trade-offs. So I only have three summary points. One, for methane, genetic selection, feed and nutrition are the most promising management practices for reducing enteric methane. For nitrous oxide, feed and animal nutrition are the most promising for reducing urinary urea and ammonia and nitrous oxide. And we certainly need to better understand the synergies and the trade-offs when we are looking at carbon and nitrogen dynamics in our animal production systems. Thank you.